I suppose you, some of you have read the book that I read. So I thought perhaps I should give you a background, the things that I did not include in the book. Perhaps that would be a good way to start it. I have critics that they have criticized me for not including the cultural milieu in which this thing took place. And I didn't do that because I was not sure where to place it. The person with whom I work is a Yaqui Indian. Yaquis live in northwestern Mexico. They are a very peculiar group of people. There are 90,000 of them today. And they have lived where they are today since before the Spaniards came to the New World. I think it was around 1718 that they voluntarily, no, 1680, around 1680, they voluntarily allowed the missionaries to come to Sonora and voluntarily underwent missionization, let's say. And they kept the Spanish missionaries for 80 years. And then one day, they burned the churches and killed them off. And ever since that time, they've been on their own, which made them very strange. And they make a very strange concoction of the Catholicism of the time, 1600s, and whatever was ancestral to them. And today, it's nearly an impossibility to untangle that, to disentangle that syncretic process, or that syncretic result. But at any rate, they involved themselves after the missionaries were expelled in a very, what would be the word? A total war against the Western man. And they have had 100 years, for instance, of solid warfare. After Mexico gained its independence, they inherited the Yaqui problem. And they coped with it finally in around the turn of the century by moving in full force, the Mexican forces, and taking the total Yaqui population and putting them in trains and boats and shipping them outside of Sonora. They shipped to southern Mexico, to the states of Yucatan and Oaxaca and Veracruz. Don Juan was very young at that time. Don Juan is the man I work with, the shaman I work with. He was very young at that time, he was a child. And he was caught in this mishmash, and he and his father were shipped to Veracruz, and then later he moved to Oaxaca. So it's very I feel today that if I want to place this shamanistic tradition in a cultural milieu, I would have to make I would have to mix whatever it's Yaqui in something in central Mexico. Don Juan learned his tradition, or whatever I call his tradition, he learned his knowledge of sorcery in Oaxaca. Therefore, he goes every year to Oaxaca in order to collect some hallucinogenic mushrooms that are very important in elucidating his knowledge. Those mushrooms do not grow in Sonora. They grow exclusively in Oaxaca. And the whole tradition of mushroom, the mushroom cult, comes from that area. He uses also the a cactus, Lophophora williamsis, the peyote, commonly known as peyote, which grows in the northern part of Mexico. And it's my belief that Don Juan has made, again, like taking perhaps the Yaqui format or syncretism, since the Yaqui is already had made this syncretic process, amalgamating Catholicism, whatever was ancestral to them. Perhaps there's a facility for them at that level to intake from different areas and make a conglomerate. And perhaps this knowledge is, it could be classified as belonging in essence to the Yaquis. It's the Yaqui spirit. The Yaquis, like I was saying, and perhaps I should continue this, they are warriors. And at the turn of the century, they were defeated by the Mexican forces in actual battles. And after they lost the battles, then they were disintegrated as a nation. They stay in central Mexico for 40 years. And then after the war, Mexico is sort of a herald of democracy among us, the Latins, Latin nations. And what was very critical at the time after the war was what had happened in Europe. Hitler moving populations, you see, displacing them. And then all of a sudden the Mexicans realized that they had done the same thing with the Yaquis. So they brought them back again to Sonora. they round them up again and back to this reservation, sort of. It's a large area that they constructed as a reservation. And they have maintained, you see, the original land. The Mexican government allowed them to come back again to the core or the ancestral land. It is composed of 8 towns. And they have, but by the time you see the Yaquis were gone in 40 years, the Mexicans have encroached on the land. They have subdivided it. It was open for colonization or something like that. And now that you have the problem, you see, of Mexican populations living next to Yaqui populations, but they do not mix. And the Yaquis are very, they say, famous for the sense of aloofness. It's very hard to get to them. Very hard to know them. Very hard to work with them. It's especially hard for me, because although I come from Latin America, you know, I look like a Mexican to them. I'm a Mexican. And they call them Yoris. It's a very despective term. You see, terribly, it's a terrible word. And it's very difficult for me to get, it would be easier for an American anthropologist, for an Anglo-Saxon anthropologist to come to the Yaqui land than it is for me. For me, it's nearly an impossibility. And the only way that I have halfway enter into it is through the auspices of Don Juan and his son. And they halfway tolerate me. They don't know what I'm doing anyways, you know, they have this weird conception that I may be a spy from an American mining company that has been... and the funny thing is that mining company has been trying to get into Sonora to explore the copper ores of some of the Yaqui mountains since 1947, the time the Yaquis came back. And the strange story is that there's no mining company that ever tried to exploit the ores. It's just an illusion, the Yaqui mine. But anyway, I'm the spy of that imaginary company. So they tolerate me in some way. You know, by now I think I don't bother them too much. But it's terribly hard to get to know the Yaquis. And I think it's the result, the reason for it is their endemic warfare against the Western man. But that's the Yaqui spirit. They are truly warriors. Not soldiers, because they are not disciplined in that sense. It's another concept. And what I have been trying to do, then, with the book that I published, in the whole work that I've done, is trying to get into the cognitive system. First of all, Old Don Juan, because that was the person I worked with. And see if by doing that, I would have been able to determine, let's say, a cognitive map of what is the Yaqui spirit. Whatever Don Juan talks about as the spirit, a warrior spirit. But I did not have that aim in mind when I went to do my field work. This is a post facto. Upon reconsidering, finishing my field work and sitting on my desk, I have reconsidered the whole process, and I have said, this is a very good thing if I would try to look for a cognitive map. It's a totally a post facto rationale. What happened to me in the field is something else. I went to, my interest in Don Juan is it was a fortuitous affair. I was interested in collecting medicinal plants when I was an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate student, and I conceived that the way to move in the ladder, you see, of the scholarship is to publish, of course. And I felt that the easiest way to get something publishable would be to collect medicinal plants. Very clever, eh? And all you got to do is record the name, procure your dry specimen, have it identified in the botanical garden, and write whatever they say about it. I thought I was a very clever young man. But that was my interest. But I didn't know any Indians. Second problem. I knew a guy who knew Indians, though, which in my mind was as good as knowing an Indian. I was unsophisticated, let's say, in that way. So I had a friend, very good friend of mine, who lived in Arizona at that time. And he claimed, you know, that he knew a great deal about Indians and plants. So I went to, I paid him a visit one summer, and I stayed with him for a long time. And I collected 80 of his plants, of course, in his descriptions. And he says, you could check this with any Indian around here. And they'll tell you that whatever I'm telling you is this, that's what they do with them. And then he said to me at that time, there is, however, one old foggy, some crony that lives somewhere around there, that knows a great deal about peyote. And perhaps, you know, if we're going to talk to him, maybe we should go and look him up. So we drove around, you know, and asked for directions, and then misled us deliberately. And we wound up in some hills out there, no man's land. And by the time, so about time to go home for me, so I gave it up, you know, it's nonsense to look for this old foggy that knew a great deal about peyote. And so I was about to take the bus to go home when this old man walked into the Greyhound Depot. And this friend of mine says, that's the Indian, that's the old man. And he went and talked to him. This friend of mine have this, we have this strange relation. He pretends to speak Spanish. He says glosolalia, you see, he just talks in tongues. And then over a period of years, you know, at first it was a joke, you know, and I tag along, you know, telling, you know, answering him in Spanish when he was just, you know, giving me this jazz, you know, this. Talking in tongues to me, pretending that was Spanish, so somebody else could hear it and think that he speaks Spanish. So at first it was a joke, but then he believed that he speaks Spanish. He got to really believe that. And he's embarrassed me to no end, I'll tell you. Sometimes he hits me, you know, with people like, you know, important people perhaps that I don't want to fool around with, and he speaks to me in Spanish. Horrendous. And that day he hit me with that. That was his pitch. He went and talked to this old man in Spanish. And the old guy laughed, you know. I was listening there, you know. And it was pretty funny what he said. It was preposterous, you know. He was making up words. And then he left me. He talked to the old Indian in Spanish. And he turned around and left. And there I was standing with this old man. he was laughing, you know, it was very funny. I liked him. I noticed that he had a nice sense of humor. And then I made my pitch, my anthropologist pitch at that point. I decided that perhaps that was the man I could turn into a key informant. But how do you proceed? You see, I was inexperienced. So I decided that the only way to do would be to sell myself to him and tell him that I knew a great deal about peyote. And I told that. I says, listen, I says, I know all there is to know about peyote. Perhaps it'll be, you know, convenient for you. It'll be advantageous to you if you talk to me. And the guy just looked at me. He just looked at me and laughed. But there was something very peculiar about the way he looked. That was quite exciting, I thought, because you know I'm a little persistent, perhaps because I'm short. Yeah. Learn to be, you either crash or you learn very funny mechanics. You see, so I'm very persistent, and I'm not dissuaded too easily. You had to clobber me on the head to dissuade me. But this guy stopped me by looking at me. That was weird. No, there was something wrong there. I mean, I felt like my body recorded something wrong. Very weird. Yeah, I'm not given to, I'm not a mystic man, see, at all. I'm very pragmatic. I proceed in a specific ways. You know, I'm not scared that easily. But how could this guy stop me just looking? That was something strange. And then he said, yes, perhaps you could come and see me sometime, you know, maybe we could talk in my house. And then again, this time he says, oh, there's my bus. He just got out. There's no bus out there. He just said that to me. I think he cut me off. So I came back to see him because he interests me personally. It was an interest, personalistic interest. And I came back, and 6 months later, I came back and looked him up. And he had moved from Arizona to Sonora. And I found him, and we got to talk. You know, and he was very amenable man. There's some very peculiar sensation of control about him that I noticed at that time. It's very nice to be around one. I don't know what it is, but he makes me feel complete, very nice, concise. There's no loose ends. There's no fretting, no excitation, unnecessary excitation. Yet he's capable of exerting himself dramatically to a fantastic point, which is the opposite of what I find in my time, or what I am. I fret. I've been described by a friend of mine as being as nervous as a cockroach. Perhaps he's right. You see, I'm very nervous, and yet there's no conciseness about me. Perhaps that's the reason why I like Don Juan. I like his touch. And I came to see him over and over for a period of a year. And I had developed in this year this sing-song, this slogan. Every time I saw him, I said, when are you going to teach me about peyote? And he would laugh, you know, discard my question. Until one day he took me up. And that was the beginning for this strange thing that was this apprenticeship. Apprenticeship to his knowledge. Or I became an apprentice, not quite of his apprentice, I feel, but it's an apprenticeship to a system, to a way of being. And after 4 years, I withdrew from it because it became threatening. It became too anguishing. And as perhaps you know, once who have read this book that I've written, Don Juan used 3 hallucinogenic plants in order to teach his knowledge. Now, he used the cactus, Lophophora williamsii is called peyote, Jimson weed, is one of the Datura plants, and those hallucinogenic mushrooms, one of the species, one of 14 species
of hallucinogenic mushrooms that grow in central Mexico and belong to the genus Psilocybin. Now, the reason for my withdrawal, as I see it today, was very simple. We have a picture of the world that has been given to us through processes of socialization. And then we have a preconception already ingrained in us of what the world is like. And we call that reality, the reality of everyday life. It's the world taken for granted that we assume it's there. And what's more, we assume that we could give ourselves consensus on the elements of that world from now to the day we die. And I don't, like, for instance, taking this to an extreme, I don't need anybody anymore to be a person, a social entity. I could be all by myself. And I have myself and the idea of the group, you, you're absent. I'm all by myself in the universe, in the world, in the world. All I need is the idea of you. And that serves as that allegedly makes a group. Meaning, I could give myself consensus because I have already learned all the consensus that came from you, the group. At one time in my like processes of socialization, my growing up. And at this time, I'm an adult. I assume that I need nobody else to tell me what is real. So the force of the world taken for granted is tremendous. We never doubt that. However, under very precarious times sometimes, perhaps circumstances, very precarious circumstances, we get to doubt. And that is a blast. And what happened to me was precisely that. Don Juan had to steer me. He had guided me to this edge. And then he pushed me. And I went all the way. And I began to doubt. I began to, let's say, to lose the certainty that the world of everyday life is something I could account for. And that, of course, is madness. That's really sheer insanity. And before I lost my mind, I thought, I better quit. And I did. I withdrew from the apprenticeship voluntarily. And I never came to see Don Juan anymore. And after that, I had time then to sit around and rehash my notes and arrange them in quotes. The arrangement is not mine. The arrangement is inherently, I presume it is, I wish it would be at least, the inherent order of some cognitive units which guided Don Juan in order to present his system as a coherent unit. And I saw Don Juan later after I didn't see him for nearly 3 years. And after the book was published, I paid him a visit because I wanted to show him the book because I had told him that I was going to write one. So I went to Central Mexico. I couldn't have a way to let him know that I was, or letting him know that I was coming to see him. But I did, I found him. And he was in this town in Central Mexico, and I took the book and I showed it to him, and he looked at it, he liked it, and he flipped the pages, and then I got a surge of pride and said, I want you to have it. And the one says, I better not. You know what we do with paper in Mexico? That was his opinion of the book. I thought it was great. I thought it was a lovely touch. So ever since that time, you see, I have felt, you know, that perhaps, you know, my fear of losing my mind was a little bit of an exaggeration. And of course, you know, under certain circumstances, you know, we would tend to exaggerate our importance dramatically. And that was one of the occasions for me. I felt, you know, that I was losing something terribly important, my mind. So then I felt compelled to withdraw. But later on, see, with 3 years in between, I changed many of my views. So I have come back again, you know, to see Don Juan, to visit him. Not again, not to participate in his apprenticeship, but rather to talk to him. But it's very difficult to talk to a sorcerer. You see, you're playing with fire. So he hooked me again, you know, into following his way of being, of probably, I could say perhaps that what's enticing about him is that his view of the world is very exciting. It's so new. I feel that it's so much more functional, perhaps more rational than mine. And in the lapse of time between when I withdrew completely from the apprenticeship until the time I went back to see him again, I grew a little tired of rehashing myself again, because that's what I'm condemned to do if I'm left to my own devices. I rehash my meaning over and over, and I come up with the same result. I'm looking at myself, and I'm very boring when it comes to that, terribly boring. So I got tired, you know, looking at me. And perhaps that's one of the very key factors at this point why I went back to see Don Juan. And he hooked me with an abstract this time. The first time, you know, there was I had no idea what he was doing. This time I willfully or willingly I have let him guide me. He is interested at this point, quote, or teaching me the difference between looking at the world and seeing. He makes a semantic difference between looking and seeing. Now, his interest is, as I see it, in giving me a series of memories of colon blank. Now, when he says, for instance, that one or that a sorcerer could turn into a crow, he's giving me a unit of meaning, turning into a crow, for which I have no equivalent. And his teachings consist in forcing me to acquire, and I say to acquire, a series of memories of turning into a crow, that is. And it's presupposed that at a given moment, my brain is going to assemble all those units and turn it into what in the phenomenological jargon we could call it a gloss. Example, I say to you, tree, and apparently I make sense. However, if you ask me what I mean by a tree, I'll spend the rest of my life trying to figure out what I mean by a tree. And all I could give you is a series of historical facts about a tree, historical facts that I had learned as I grew up. I could give you the anatomy of a tree, the works, name it. But the assumption is that I have never apprehended the phenomena tree. It may be there, but it looks that it's in here, because I am interpreting it. And I'm interpreting the phenomena tree through a set of concise, preordained mechanics, preordained units. I've been taught to perceive tree. And at this point, my assumption is that I have never seen it. Perhaps I've seen tree once, twice. But I could tell you in all sincerity that I have never seen elephant. Because when did I see an elephant? When I was, let's see, 2 years old, 6 months old? Never. The gloss elephant has come to me fully formed. Now, through what processes I could say elephant, it really makes sense. We really don't know that. We have not been concerned with that yet in social science. We're beginning to now. Like, the gloss elephant to me is in addition, not the gloss tree, because it's obvious that I saw trees when I was, what, 2 days old, 3 days old, whatever. Before I learned the gloss tree, I had seen the gloss room before it became a gloss. And my assumption is that a certain time in my life, I may have walked into a room and even may have known the utterance room, but I didn't know the total gloss room. It required a series of memories of walls, chairs, floor, ceiling to complete the gloss. And what the one is doing, as I see it, is giving me again the processes of glossing. He's teaching me the mechanics of glossing. And that's the thesis that I wanted to throw out for a feedback. Now, my crucial point is this. In his effort to teach me to see, the one says that seeing consists in training your eyes, of course, through the uses of hallucinogenic plants. The hallucinogenic plants allegedly give you the speed to apprehend, quotes, a fleeting world. Without the hallucinogenic plants, you would degenerate, your body would deteriorate. You could do it in the terminology of the quest of the American Indian, the quest for visions. You could do that. The one took me already for 10 days to the desert out there. And then 10 days I would have been capable of seeing anything, I promise you. And it was just a horrendous experience because I was tired, the fatigue. And I'm weak, you see, I don't have the stamina of an Indian. So I think I collapsed after the second day. But the thing prolonged itself for 10 days. And I found that I suffered a tremendous loss. I lost weight in the first place, and the losing of moisture in the tissues. It's deleterious. They're the health. And the one says that, on the other hand, with the use of an hallucinogenic plant, you suffer no deterioration. But you have to know what you're looking for. Like to use an hallucinogenic plant for enlightenment. It's absurd in the one terms. To use it for kicks is just a crime to yourself, because it does something to you that is irreparable. And he will never venture into anything like that. I ask him, you know, what would be his feeling about taking LSD? And give him some of it I have procured so he could watch it in his mail, and says, ooh, this is terrible, says, take it away. And he didn't want anything to do with it because he had no rationale for it. He didn't have direction for it. On the other hand, with his plans, he presumes to have a very exact direction, exact procedures that he has commanded. And he feels at home, he feels safe. So the aid of an hallucinogenic plant is essential in seeing, because it allows you the speed to apprehend this fleeting world. But what is this fleeting world? What's he talking about? I say that he is talking about a process of re-glossing. He's teaching me to gloss the same way that my progenitors and my fellow men taught me as a child the ordinary glosses. I suppose there is an infinite number of glosses. Or like the gloss room. It's either an infinite number of concrete glosses that we use, or it's a pattern of glossing that we have learned, and then we apply it to everything we perceive. Either way. But the one what he's doing now, as I say, as a social scientist that is, I say that he's teaching me to regloss. But he, alluding that one could see, he is alluding that there's possible to see an ultimate reality. And that, of course, we know it cannot be true. At least we, the social scientists, know that that's bunk. That there is an ultimate reality. I don't know at this moment what will be the end result of it. All I can tell you is that I'm going to try to apprehend what he calls the fleeting world, and see that perhaps, or find out whether it is really a process of reglossing. I hope that I'll be sober enough to realize that it's a process of reglossing, or if there is the possibility of seeing, or quote, seeing or apprehending an irreducible reality. Ludwig Wittgenstein, in his life, you know, attempted to resolve the problem. And he found, I think, he talked about language, the trappings of natural language. And I think Wittgenstein's dilemma was that he arrived to an edge that it was an impasse. You have the phenomena there that you want to describe. Is the phenomena in the description two things, or is the description part of the phenomena? For as a social scientist, as an anthropologist, I'm going to study primitive cultures. But what can you say about my description and my conclusions about the primitive culture I'm trying to study? Is it part of the primitive culture? Or is it a phenomenon in itself? Wittgenstein never resolved the problem. He felt, you see, the trappings of language. He called it natural language as opposed to philosophical syntax. There was a time in which the idea was that perhaps we could develop a language which was exact, a language of philosophers, and we would be able to agree without doubt about what we're talking about in terms of philosophizing. And that seems to be an impossibility. The question is that we use language and the meaning of language is arbitrary. So, we are filled with words in Wittgenstein's terms. And there is nothing in here except vocalizations. So is that all I am? Just words? According to Wittgenstein, that's all we are. Words, 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 words. And he saw no possibility of breaking or flipping through this barrier of natural language. However, Don Juan, very strangely, coming from the outside, you see, I we should tend to believe that, you see, that only us, the Europeans, are capable of rational thought. We are the only ones who think. The rest of them are just greasy Indians, you know. Nothing. But we are not considered them seriously. And it's a very strange development. I have read, in fact, you know, I have finished this manuscript on seeing, and I like to start it by quoting an inquisitor, a Spanish inquisitor that came to the New World in 1572. And he wrote a fantastic treatise in how to exterminate idolatry. And he says that the American Indians, they claim to have powers to divine, and with the aid of some diabolic seeds, they really succeeded in divining things, he said. And to his knowledge, he cites three cases in which he really corroborated this divination power. And then he concludes with a parenthetical statement. He says, however, the Lord Jesus Christ is missing in this system. And I must conclude that is the work of the devil. It must be exterminated. And he throws that out of the window. But oddly enough, we do the same thing today with our scientific method. And the idea that trivial models equivalent to how many angels sit in the head of a pin should be thrown out because they are meaningless. And then by some process unknown to me, we lump everything that has been done by non-Europeans in the realm of the trivial models, and out they go, like what the American Indian has done. We don't take it seriously. Not really, because it's an oddity, but not as serious as Kant. Not as serious as Husserl, as old Wittgenstein. Never, never. And my proposition was that perhaps maybe we should attempt to take them seriously. Like what Don Juan is posing to me as a man. You see, the crux of the matter is that I am a man who's going to die. I cannot avoid that. Therefore, my very short period of consciousness is terribly important to me. And as a man who's going to die, this the one tossing to me is monumental, because perhaps it gives me the opportunity of breaking the barriers of natural language. The one that I have been criticized for this book that I've written, it says that it's hardly believable that that an Indian would speak that way. Perhaps me, who concocted all this. I mean, did he really say that? That was the question. And I say, he said that. It's very simple. Don Juan deals with an area he calls seeing, an area of ambiguity from the standpoint of natural language. In that area of ambiguity, there are no glosses that he could use to describe or to analyze. If there are no glosses at his disposal, he has to make use of metaphor, therefore art, in order to convey meaning. And therefore he speaks beautifully, because he doesn't know what else to do with that area he calls, quotes, seeing. And maybe that is the crux of the matter in terms of all the trappings of natural language. Perhaps if we are right to that area for which we have no gloss, we'll be able to flip the coin, bypass the impasse that supposedly has finished all the philosophers. Because they all arrive to the same vicious circle. Some of them are wise, quote, wise enough to say, let's stop here and let's just consider our gains. And Santayana calls that, he says, I know that what I'm doing is right because of animal faith. And that's the end of it. But he doesn't want to go beyond that because he knows that he will be, again, you know, in a vicious circle going around and around without any solution. And I say that that stems from the fact that he, or all of us, we are rehashing glosses that we know so very well. Maybe it's high time to see, quote, or to envision life from the point of view of an alien culture that has given us a solution which is non-European. Perhaps Don Juan has given me a series of shamanistic glosses, or maybe not. Maybe what he's teaching me to do is to de-gloss. So that's the thesis that I wanted to propose to you for your examination. You see what you say about it. Now, if you ask me some questions, you will have my motor going.
You characterize Don Juan as a man living roughly in an alien culture, as his people and his way of life doesn't predominate in Mexico, but he's able to live within that, roughly speaking, alien culture. Now, when you've gone down there, you've said that he teaches you to rehash glosses, or perhaps get you to a point in which you don't have to make glosses, you just have an experience. And you characterize this as more exciting and perhaps more rational than your own way of life.
Yes.
Now, did he teach you anything? That is, did he in fact, you said that you went away from it, even though it was more exciting and more rational.
Yes.
But have you learned to experience things
no.
in a different way?
No.
Would you like to?
Well, I would like to, but I see the at a certain level, the power of natural language is so exuberant.
But why, if he can live in an alien culture, that is, he presumably has some contact with the sort of thing that you have.
Perhaps.
But you haven't yet.
You see, maybe the trick is that, you see, he doesn't have to contend with the richness of my world. My world is super rich. I have the victories of the scientific method to back me up. And then in the back of my mind, like I was telling some friends today, when I arrive to a state of great fatigue, of real fatigue, of when my maze disintegrates, borrowing Dr. Wallace's terminology, what do? I become very religious. But like, for instance, Don Juan has shown me in a very pragmatic, dramatic way, this deity called Mezcalito that inhabits the peyote buttons, or rather that you see through the aid of the peyote buttons. I even touch it. It's pragmatic, like this blackboard to me. it should be proper to say that I'm affiliated with it because it happens only yesterday, you know, very recently. But no, whenever I am very tired, I become what I call a Jesus boy. I fall to my knees and I become thoroughly Catholic. I confess my sins, all the works, the works. There's a friend who's written a song based on this. The name of the song is "When the Potatoes Are Hot, I Am a Jesus Boy." and that's the thing, you see, I cannot break away from the trappings of natural language. Maybe an Indian has more facility than I.
Given your initial model, are you structuring it similar to the Socratic model, or do you find similarities in the Aki model with the Socratic model, seeking its own reality, Platonic reality?
No. I have not made any relationship at all.
But do you see relationship?
I refuse to see at this point any relationship because I become, you know, if I learn a little, if I start comparing, I lose tonality. And I become, let's say, a biased another.
But aren't you really comparing when
Wittgenstein, yes. Out of necessity. No, I think it's a little, I don't know how to, I haven't done what you are proposing there, but and I wouldn't know how. Wittgenstein attracted me.
You have to use your language completely because you can't communicate.
The only person who ever talked to me about getting rid of language is Ludwig Wittgenstein. That's why I like him. See, that's the reason why I brought it. Otherwise, I wouldn't even bring it into the picture. But he's the only one who gave me the clue, the entry to this. Because otherwise I had to accept that my conclusions about my work are not part of the phenomena. They are a side of it, and they are truth. They are truthful. They could really give me, let's say, the entry to understand the phenomena. But are my conclusions really giving me an entry to understand anything? I doubt at this point. There was a time in which I would have defended that point, but at this point, thanks to Ludwig Wittgenstein, I'm in a terrible mess. Yes?
Have you ever considered the trappings of natural language to be almost the same as perhaps the egocentricity of Western man?
Yes, certainly. I was in fact talking today about and Don Juan's been telling me this for years. The idea that I have to lose importance. Like the importance of myself is intimately related, in my case, as perhaps not in yours, but in my case, to whining. I whine like the devil. You know, all my life I've been whining. You know, nothing is right. Everything is wrong. This kind of anxiety attached to this. Things that are not in the best terms for me. And I think that's very closely related to the idea that egocentric involvement, that I'm involved with my importance. Not only, do you say egocentric or ethnocentric? Now, see, that's, and then the one insists that the proper way is to lose importance, to lose the sense of importance. And he claims to have lost completely the sense of importance about his ego. And yet he's capable of functioning in the world. He functions in the world via another unit of meaning that is truly incomprehensible to me, although he has attempted to explain it to me. He calls it controlled folly. And he says that the only way he could involve with his fellow men is through the means of controlled folly. And he told me this in 1964. And I never hit upon the idea. Until now, 1969, only 4 or 5 months ago, I read my notes, my old notes, and I went back to ask him. I said, well, what is control folly? And he nearly fell back laughing. He hit his leg and says, I'm so glad that you asked me about that after so many years. Although, if you have never asked me, it wouldn't have mattered. Yes, yet, says, I pretend, I act as though it is important and it matters. And yet I know that it doesn't matter. That is control folly, he said. So it was sort of gibberish for me. And that's the idea, he says that he deliberately involves himself in an act, and he acts it truthfully, not in a phony way. He acts it. When he retreats from the act, he has no pains, no anguish. I do the opposite. I involve myself in an act, and if it doesn't work to my satisfaction, knives. The psychiatrist. Sir.
Did Don Juan have a teacher?
Yes.
And he learned these things from a teacher.
That's the assumption.
Because these are things that you're saying is definitely, you know, a need for us to come in contact with these, and yet there's no method suggested. And are you putting these out as a saying that you yourself are still looking for a method, or is there a method that you can suggest as far as?
No, I see the method. Although I have worked with one for nearly 9 years now, all I have caught are glimpses of this methodology. By the time I learned quotes to see, I will have the full-fledged method, meaning, in my terms, perhaps, I will have acquired all the mechanics of glossing as a shaman, let's put it that way, so we will make ourselves happy. Or perhaps, as the anthropologist does, or perhaps, you know, I will learn what he pretends to what he pretends is that one could apprehend, as I said, this ultimate reality. And once you do it, everything fits in place. Then the methodology will be self-evident. I don't know. I have no idea. Yes.
In your book, it seemed that Don Juan thought that Mescalito was very fond of you and wanted you to see him.
Yeah.
Mescalito wanted you to see him.
Yeah.
And yet, from what you say, you don't feel that you have understood Mescalito, or that you are naturally inclined toward understanding the things that Don Juan was trying to teach you. Why do you think that Don Juan said that Mescalito liked you so much?
Well, I don't know. Like, perhaps, like, again, going back to this idea of control falling. I asked Don Juan, in order to explain this, I asked Don Juan if control falling meant that his acts were the acts of an actor. There are no sincerity in them. And he says, my acts are the acts of an actor, but they are sincere. And then I said, I probe a little further, and says, but when do you exercise this calling? And he says, all the time. I said, with whom? He says, with everybody. I thought, I mean, really weird. And he says, you mean that you don't care whether I live or die, whether I learn or not, whether I flip? And he says, no, I don't care. And that really struck me, you know, like a ton of bricks. Because I have, you know, being a European, a partial European, I have learned to move in terms of being liked or disliked. If somebody likes me personally, I feel fine and gorgeous. If they dislike me, terror. And I believe that Don Juan liked me personally. Therefore, I trusted him. And upon learning that he didn't really care, you know, this horrendous neurosis set on me. And I felt really lost. And I said, but why do you want to teach me then? And he says, well, I don't care. It's not my doing. He says, you were pointed out to me by this deity contained in peyote. And he says, I don't know his reasons. He must have some reasons for it. Therefore, it's none of his business. The one's business is to acknowledge this supernatural omen and proceed according to his beliefs. You see that you have to transmit it. But it's not really his will. It's not his volition. And the reason why I'm not, they say, perhaps the trappings of the European, my European socialization, my Western man socialization, are so profound that there's no way to break them. except intellectually. Now, if I knew that I'm going to spend my life in a classroom teaching and never again end up in the desert, I could say anything I want. But you see, after I talk to you, next week I'm going to see Don Juan. And I begin smack against something, the tremendum. I cannot lie. You see, I feel incapacitated to construct anything of my own. And if I don't understand, if I have no affinity to the deities he's talking about, I better say that I have no affinity to them, because this is something that is very, very natural for me. Maybe I didn't answer the question, did I? Yes.
You said that he does not care about himself or about you or about other people, and that the acts that he's going through and does are a sort of absurd happenings, like maybe the 20th century literature presents happenings that are absurd, that you cannot explain, but they do happen.
Yes.
What really has anything in meaning to him? What about the whole world, like unity? Like
no, I think, maybe we could find, let's say, an attempt to an explanation in the mythology of the Siberian, from where the word shamanism comes, and allegedly the total syndrome of shamanism may be alluded to happen in Siberia. They have the tale, that a shaman goes to the netherworld before he becomes a shaman, finds a spirit helper that kills him, dismembers him, and boils or eats or different processes the flesh out of his bones. And once the bones are clean of flesh, he assembles them back and puts the man again into the world as a non-man. What would it be perhaps pertinent would it be to explain that in terms of meaning? What would happen to a sorcerer if he robs allegiance to meaning? If he learns to subtract allegiance, he becomes a dehumanized person. No longer a human being in the terms we understand. Rather, no longer a person, no longer a social entity. What makes us social entities is that we believe that the meaning of certain things are important to us. We are aligned to meaning. Otherwise, we couldn't function, we say. However, Don Juan has no allegiance to meaning. He may have an allegiance to a super order. I don't know that. I really have no idea. My judgment would be that his allegiance is to the super order, the shamanistic super order. But I have problem in that line. He says that that's not so, that he has no allegiance, that nothing is more important than anything else. Insisting nothing is more important, I say, when he said that, I said, do you mean that everything is worthless? Because that's my cognitive reaction. If something is not important, something is equally important, that means I'm worthless. And he says, no, I didn't mean worthless, I mean unimportant. Things were unimportant because they were equal. Thus, only through the offices of control folly, he could embark himself in interaction. That's the meaning. It's a very difficult thing. I have not really understood what he meant. I'm rendering as exact as possible what he said, in the hope that I'll be able to come up with some.
What's your birthday?
What's my what? I was described by this astrologer as a structure freak. I'm a Capricorn. He says Capricorns are structure freaks. Weak men and strong women.
All you're doing is exercising folly right now.
No! I'm very serious because I really would like to get...
No.
You see, I really don't understand how one could really divest intellectually. Of course, I do the same thing that you do. I understand what Don Juan is saying. He's verbalizing something that is very neat to me. However, let me proceed then and embark myself on control folly, and I fall flat on my face because I cannot rub importance to things. I become passionately involved.
Consciously, you may not be doing it, but subconsciously, you must be.
But I was conscious
and stuff. You can't tell us the truth, yet a lot of the patterns of your language fall together.
But I was conscious and stuff.
You're saying you can't tell us the truth, yet a lot of the patterns of your language fall together in patterns that aren't
the truth. The are or the aren't?
The are.
Maybe I didn't explain it correctly. For me to know something means that I could repeat that at any given moment. And if I want to proceed exercising control folly, I couldn't even go to the corner. I get trapped in meaning immediately upon my, like for instance, what? I cannot even conceive, sincerely, I cannot conceive one instance in which I did not find the instance meaningful. That's what I meant to say.
Let's see if I understand. Do you mean by control folly might be making an arbitrary choice to act and then following upon the consequences of that from then on?
Something like that. Although it's arbitrary in the sense that it follows. Let's say Don Juan has already a cognitive system that allows him to choose. I don't know what it is. I have no idea what guides Don Juan to make a choice. He says that his guide is that he wants to take a path with heart in whatever he does. Whatever the choice is, has to be a path with heart, meaning an alternative that is amenable to him. An alternative with which he could identify without harassment to himself. And then he follows it because it cannot lead anywhere, anyways.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think his hand is up.
Oh.
That's very good.
Right.
I had a question.
Yes.
I'm not clear on what you said. I'm not sure I understand the apology. You said at first that you gave it up because of fear of going mad, or going into madness, however you put it. Then you reconsidered and wanted to go back again and try this again. The question is, why is it a question of madness at all, when one is free, so to speak?
Well, that I cannot decide that. You know, I have already learned to understand the world in specific terms. And whenever you start losing the certainty, the accountability for the everyday life reality, you are mad. That's what I've been taught. And I had to repeat exactly. Well, I don't know what I don't know how you do. You mean to say that perhaps we could set up an arbitrary rationale?
Well, I'm talking about the non-linear reality that you're talking about.
Yeah, it is madness. You see, from a strict
from our level.
And that's the only level I have. You see, it's the European level.
Well, that's not true.
Intellectually, I do. Emotionally, I'm still in Europe, kosher Europe, in fact. Yes.
Well, the implications are that when you, as an anthropologist, go into this field situation, you start out with your hypotheses and with your methods preformed and all of your glosses intact. And if you were to go into the field with these methods to gain data to fulfill a hypothesis, you would of course find them. And you find it in several years, be not touched by the culture or the person you're dealing with and come back. What you're attempting to do is to sink into, as it were, the worldview. Now, what happens if you succeed in utterly sinking into his worldview to your models? Will you be able to communicate with us at all?
Well, certainly.
The same process that he does, or is there some model which will somehow translate in a bare facsimile of what he's trying to say?
Perhaps, if we want to be truly scientific, think of this possibility. Perhaps if we could map a system of glossing which is proper of us, the Europeans, and then a system of glossing which is proper of all the culture we're studying, and see where they overlap, maybe that's the only thing that could be assessed, is that overlap. Because I go already with my preconceptions. The prejudgment about the world is set in me. My glosses are there. And I'm going to go and judge the glosses of people alien to me through my own glosses. That's absurdity.
Well, you end up with two sets of glosses that you can use.
And perhaps you could overlap them. Mm-hmm. You could overlap them, perhaps, somehow. Maybe it's a way of overlapping them. And call that overlap the only thing that could be accessible. That's it. That's the proposition. You see, in fact, you know, it's an exciting, at least to me, it's an exciting alternative in anthropology. Yes?
What are some of your speculations as to why Mescalito appointed you out?
Maybe because I'm short and brown? I don't know. Yes?
I've not read your book.
Terrible!
I just heard about it this afternoon.
No.
And so I don't know. I don't know a lot of features of this man's life, but I'd like to ask you a question about it. You seem attracted to his way of life in certain ways.
Yes.
And he's a man who knows something about your way of life.
Oh, yes.
And he seems to not do anthropological research, say, in America or other places, because from what he knows enough, presumably. He's not doing research.
No, he's not a European. He's not interested in assessing
all people. Well, two questions. One is, would you like to universalize his behavior? Because he behaves as a human being, insofar as your conceptions of human beings' behavior is concerned, in such a way that you'd like, for example, him to be president of Mexico, or president of America.
No.
Or suppose, for example,
president of the world.
What would happen if Mescalito told him that he had a mission, say, to teach in America? One, how long would he last outside of the loony bin? And
not even 2 hours. However, Don Juan says that, you know, he says that his life is an exercise in a strategy, as opposed to mine, which is an exercise in meaning. I don't watch, you see, my units. I don't set up my life in a strategical terms. That's why I get clever every turn of the way. I haven't even gotten my PhD yet. I doubt that they're here to me. There's an example, you see, of complete idiocy in the sense of not really setting up my world in strategic terms. For Don Juan, that's unthinkable. Don Juan, if he would tackle the problem of disseminating his knowledge, quotes, he would tackle it from the point of view of a strategist, not a saint, not a philosopher, just a strategist, a plain strategist. I asked him once, you who live so strategically, what will happen to you if somebody is waiting for you with a powerful rifle with a telescopic sight, you see, and ambush, ready to ambush, you have no chance. And he says, I won't come around. So that was it, you see. And he gave me a very exciting unit of meaning, not to be accessible. Think about that, because see, I am accessible. I stuck my neck in chopping. And that's what we do. We stand in the way. We love to be clobbered. The one is not accessible. Therefore, not to be on the road is the Spanish translation, you know, whatever he said. Not to place yourself on the road. So I suppose that he will not, I don't think he would tackle the idea of being the president of Mexico, but if he does, I think, I suppose he will proceed again in strategic manner.
Is that because, I mean, people have strategies only when they have ends fixed.
No.
They know what they want, then the only question remains is the means of instantiating their ends.
No.
Other people don't have ends, and then they look around for ends.
Yeah,
well,
that's, you are telling me what I know.
It's a natural, ordinary language philosophy.
You're telling me the European rationale. See, that's what I know as a European. And we're rehashing it, the same thing. I think Don Juan means something entirely different. But I think I'm holding you back here. Please, I mean, don't let me do it, because I don't have anything to do. You make me very busy. So if you want to leave, I mean, please, call it. If you want to stay, you could ask me. I'm yours. So, yes, lady.
Would you like to teach, though, what would the Greeks teach?
He would like to teach what?
Why would he want to teach?
I don't think he would want to. This is, in my case, is something for tweeters. It's a very, it's a lucky chance. And I don't think he would take it up. I doubt very much. Yes?
You said you spoke to him about LSD.
Yes.
Did you speak to him, or did you carry on any dialogue about any other hallucinogenic drugs besides the dream?
No. He doesn't know any hallucinogenic.
Like such as marijuana or...
No. He doesn't know marijuana either. No.
Is it correct to say that you were trying to analyze the cognitive process with the cognitive process?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Don wanted to do this, or did he do the opposite?
No, he doesn't. He's not trying to analyze anything. He's not trying to analyze what he has experienced. Because simply, I think, like I said, he has no natural language to cover it. So for him remains phenomena in itself.
Do you think Don Juan would say that it was possible to analyze the cognitive process?
No. That's my folly. Purely mine. Yet, you know, I will know how to stop. That's my problem.
But it's falling free. You talked about falling free. The arrived at only by releasing your opponent from the cognitive process.
I suppose though, that would be a good... I would tend to be thinking, I would be inclined to think in terms of, I don't know. Yes.
Besides the old woman, how many other Yaqui shamans are there running around?
They are all there, like I have met a Mazatec shaman. I know of a Yaqui shaman, the man who has only one arm. And then I know now a Mazatec in the central area of Mexico, who is even better than the one. He's more knowledgeable. He is, quotes, of a higher order. And he may very well be. He's a very astounding man. He's 65 years old.
Did they ever get together?
Yeah.
They
do get together in peyote meetings. All those peyote people who attend those peyote meetings are all shamans.
I wonder if we shouldn't draw the meeting to a close. Those of you who want to leave, and if you wish to stay and continue talking for a while, you're welcome to.
Thank you.